Again, we are in chapter 17, and we finished the discussion of the purpose of the scene, what God intends for us to learn. We talked a little bit about the influence that is expressed here with regard to the harlot that is introduced in chapter 17, the beast and the false prophet. And the harlot's influence as she seduced the kings of the world, that these same kings later were used to destroy her, which is some irony that God cannot be thwarted in his efforts, and actually often will utilize the same instruments that are used against him in order to accomplish his will. Just shows his supremacy, ultimately. We're going to talk a little bit more about that as time goes on. I do want to note that the next slide that we're in is what are some of the practical applications that would be evident to them as they read the book and also to us. And there are a couple of lessons. Sometimes this particular slide is a little bit more difficult to take something from it, but there is something interesting that I wanted to share with you. I want you to note that in chapter 17, in verse 3 of the text, as this vision begins, we are told that the angel carried John away in the spirit into the wilderness. Notice it is the wilderness where he is taken. And it is there that he sees the harlot. He sees the woman sitting on a scarlet beast full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. So this woman that is introduced in chapter 17 was introduced to John in the wilderness. I want you to go back to Revelation chapter 12, if you will, in the first verse there. Revelation 12. There was another woman who was introduced to John in a different scene in the visions. And we're told in verse 1 of chapter 12 that a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. Being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. Another sign appeared in heaven, a great fiery red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his heads. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and them and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. Her child was caught up to God into his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God that they should feed her there 1,260 days. So this woman flees into the wilderness. By the way, they are obviously not the same woman, but I think it's interesting as we consider the two women in the wilderness, the one mentioned in chapter 12 and the one in 17, that we examine for just a few moments some of the differences, because I think that it can truly be said that they are the antithesis of one another. You may remember in our discussion of Revelation chapter 12, that we concluded that the woman here represented the faithful remnant of God's people who are seeking God in righteousness. The Son of God came from that remnant. You'll remember the genealogy, for example, in Matthew and Luke, and the fact that he was a Jew, that as he came as the son of Abraham and the son of David to this earth, it was through them that the Messiah would come, as promised by God. And so that's the idea that we got there, the faithful remnant that remained, who were seeking God in righteousness, that they brought forth the Son, whom, of course, the dragon, which was the devil, immediately sought to devour. We can look at any number of examples concerning how efforts were made to kill Jesus, beginning with Herod the Great, as he destroyed all of the children in Bethlehem under 2 years of age. And then, of course, the fleeing into Egypt and all of the conflicts with the religious leaders of the day and ultimately his death on the cross. But we find that very much parallels what we have. So we've got the faithful remnant of God's people, and then here we have the opposite. We have a figure that we will identify, and I believe to have reference to the city of Rome. We'll explain that as we get into some other materials. But the harlot Babylon, which is just the opposite. Nothing no pursuit of righteousness, nothing pure about this harlot. She enticed the world through wickedness. And so those who were following after her, those who had the mark of the beast rather than the seal of God upon their forehead, they followed after her because they were enticed by her. That's the right idea. The idea of seduction is found very clearly and prevalently in this 17th chapter. There's a passage that I wanted to read from Proverbs chapter 6 that describes the efforts of an immoral woman. And of course, the wise man in Proverbs was trying to warn his son not to be foolish, not to be enticed or seduced by the immoral woman who dressed in the attire of a harlot. And he states in verses 23 through 28, to kind of give you a parallel of what symbolically is being done here with an actual description of how a man can fall under the influence of an evil woman. He said, "The commandment is a lamp and a law a light, the law a light. Reproofs of instruction are the way of life to keep you from the evil woman." There's an application there. How do you stay away from such evil influences? And in this specific case, how do you stay away from a seductress, given her efforts to seduce? Well, the commandments and the law, the reproofs that are offered in Scripture, they serve to immunize us, to keep us away from the efforts of this evil woman. But notice the evil woman. She has a flattering tongue, the flattering tongue of a seductress. And he tells him in verse 25, "Don't lust after her beauty in your heart, nor let her allure you with her eyelids. For by means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread. And an adulteress will prey upon his precious life. Can a man take fire into his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be seared?" So the idea is that if you allow yourself to be influenced, seduced by this harlot, this immoral woman, that ruin is inevitable. Just as inevitable as taking fire and putting it in your bosom or walking across hot coals. It's just going to burn you, and she will, in that regard, burn you. But that's exactly the illustration that we have given in this particular passage. We talk about the allurement of this harlot. Notice how she's described in verse 4. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls and had in her hand a golden cup. Now, the kings of the earth that were seduced by her didn't know what was inside the cup. But here, the presentation is outwardly something that, or someone that is enticing, someone who had the ability to allure, the ability to seduce. And that's what she did, and that's what is described in that text. And we'll talk a little bit more about the ugliness of the woman, because there is certainly an ugliness that is described here in this text. But nevertheless, she holds an appeal to those who are willing to be seduced by her. So keep that in mind with regard to things that we can note that they got from that particular text. But when we talk about that, the more important one is then the second half, and that is the applications that we can make toward ourselves. And I just want you to recognize, as we consider the contrast between the faithful remnant and how they're described in chapter 12, and then this evil, this immorality that is present, that there should be that same kind of contrast present when we contemplate us as now, as Christians, the faithful remnant of God, as we remain here on earth today. And so we'll make that distinction again between the ones who have the seal of God on their forehead and then those who are under the sway of an evil and seductive influence. The world is just that. You'll remember in James chapter 1, we're told that each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires or own lust and enticed. The enticement, that's the devil working. And that enticement is just that. It is enticing. We understand the ruin of ungodliness. We can even say that it is often the case that there is no lasting pleasure to be derived from sinful practices, on this earth, because we look at the dissolution, the ruin, the dissipation, as the Apostle Paul would say, being drunk with wine, and which is dissipation, that is destructiveness or perdition, ruin. Those descriptions are given when we allow ourselves to be taken in by worldly lusts. And yet we know that the people love the world and they would have it that way in general. We need to understand that there is great allurement there for a couple of reasons. Number one, so that we'll have an understanding of why people act the way they do. But number two, so that we will not be overthrown ourselves. Just because it looks good, because it is pleasant to the eyes and is tasty to eat, as it was with Eve, doesn't mean that it is what is best or right for you. And we need to recognize that. That's the way the devil works. The devil wouldn't have a whole lot of success if the things that he offered men had no appeal to them. But they do, constantly. Just as this woman appealed to the worldly in that day. And we need to recognize that and recognize that we are to live differently than the world. I'm reminded of passages such as 1 Peter 4 that tells us we have spent enough of our past lifetime living the way the Gentiles live. Or in 1 John chapter 2, where the admonition is given, do not love the world or the things in the world, because if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Identifies the three things, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life. These things are of the world, are passing away, but he who does the will of God abides forever. That's 1 John 2, verses 15 through 17. So that's something that is applicable for us. Recognize that this woman, this harlot that is mentioned in this text, is not described as being physically ugly. Ugly in character, ugly in action, ugly in deceit, but physically attractive. She is in the attire of a harlot, and her whole purpose is to deceive and influence the world. And she is very capable of doing just that, and does it. And, whenever I see this, what comes to my mind immediately, and it's a wrong idea, is as I read this and I think of Medusa and of Greek mythology, whose face was supposedly so horrid that it brought a man to stone if you looked upon her face. That's not what you see here. This is something that catches the eye. And it allures the weak, and as such, it is something that is destructive and also something that in its allurement can catch us as well. And we're to be the opposite of that. We're to stand in contrast to the world. So worldliness is to be rejected. We must not allow ourselves to be enticed by such influences. So there is a lesson about worldliness that I think is taught here in the text. Anybody want to add anything to that? Any other applications that you can think of that we can make from the text before we get into a discussion of the meaning of the various characters and symbols? All right, well then we'll go on. Now, if you'll notice up on the list, it is a full list. Some of the things that are found here are simple for us to discuss, but I think we're going to get hopefully we'll get through most of the first column, and then next week we'll be able to get through the column quickly and get into the 18th scene in chapter 18. But I do want to spend some time talking about these things and trying to not only describe who the characters refer to, but the lesson that is being taught in this particular text concerning the judgment that would come upon this evil empire, the oppression that was present at that particular time. So let's start off with the angels. That's one that's pretty simple for us to know. We understand that the angels have reference to God's messengers and those that God has appointed to complete his work. We've already been introduced to these seven angels in the previous chapter, in chapter 16, because they're the angels that carried out the judgment of God by pouring out the bowls of wrath upon the world. And we went and discussed those things. Well, one of those angels is the one who speaks with John on this particular occasion. And he talks about the great harlot. So, who is the great harlot? There are disagreements as to who the great harlot is. She is identified in the text. Notice, if you will, the description that is given. For example, in chapter or in verse 1 of the text, We're told that she sits on many waters. We'll talk about what the many waters are as we continue. In fact, in verse 15, there is a reference that is made to that. Verses 3 through 6, the primary description that is given indicates that she's arrayed in queenly garments. That's the significance of the fact that she was arrayed in purple and scarlet. I would remind you that the synthesized dyes that we have in the world today that allow us to have so many colors, just every color in the spectrum, I suppose, can be replicated in cloth. They didn't have that. They had only natural dyes to utilize. And you might say they lived kind of a monochromatic life when it came to what they wore. And the only exceptions to this were people who were very rich, because purple dye was something that was not easy to obtain and it was very costly. And so when we're talking about dress of purple and scarlet, the immediate reference is of royalty. And that will be important as we seek to identify who the harlot is. So she's arrayed in queenly or royal garments. Her jewelry is very expensive. She is adorned with gold, precious stones, and pearls, and even the description given of the golden cup. Now, granted, it is full of abomination and filthiness, but you don't know that by looking at the outside of the cup. Kind of reminds me of what Jesus said about whited sepulchres with regard to the religious leaders of the day. They outwardly seem clean, but inwardly they're full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. And that's kind of the way it was with this cup. So she's got the cup in her hand. You look at it, it is a beautiful golden cup. This is richness. This is royalty. This is someone of importance, someone who is attractive. But in the cup, there is that filth and abomination that we'll talk about a little bit later. Also, you'll notice in verse 5 of the text, on her forehead, there's a name written. Now, here we find the first specific identification of who the woman is. She is Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. That's who she is. So we've got her identified. Well, yes and no, because when we say, okay, well, if she is Babylon, to what does that refer? Does it refer to Babylon on the Euphrates? Does it refer to something else? Because Babylon, actually, at the time in which the book of Revelation was written, had long been destroyed, did not exist as a city at that particular time. So perhaps there's a reference to some other city, and Babylon is used as a figure, which I believe is exactly the case. You'll notice as well, she is drunk with the blood of saints and martyrs, which shows something of her ugliness, if you will. And then in verse 9 of the text, there is a reference to what she sits upon. And this again shows you the symbolic nature of the text, because we've already been told she sits on many waters, but now she's sitting on mountains. We're told in verse 9, the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. So the woman sits on seven mountains. And then finally, in verse 18 of the text, it again identifies. This is the other concrete method of identification or statement of identification given. The woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. So we've got two specific, you've got descriptions, but you've got two identifying characteristics of this woman. One is that she is named Babylon the Great, and the other is that she is a great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. So, what city are we talking about? Now, again, your view of what city we're talking about, again, will be colored by, possibly, your view of when the book is written. And there are a number of possibilities that are mentioned. We'll talk a little bit about them as we seek this description. There are some who say that it has reference to Jerusalem. There are some that say it has reference to Rome. Some say it has reference to Babylon and expected some resurrection of the city of Babylon sometime in the future. They are typically futurists or speculators, with regard to what the text teaches. In other words, most of the events have not yet happened and will happen sometime in our future. And then some view this as a description of the Roman Catholic Church and the woman as being the Pope of Rome. So you look in various commentaries, and there are a lot of different views as to what is under consideration. So, this is the point that I want to make, that there is nothing in the description. I take that position that the book was written in AD 96 or thereabouts, during the reign of Domitian, who was the emperor of Rome, and that the Roman empire is constituted or embodied in the beast upon which the woman sits. And so it's a natural progression for me to take that then, that the woman and the great city in this particular context would be Rome itself. So Rome guides the beast. Rome is the head of the beast. Rome is not the head of the beast, but the one is in control of the beast. And so that would be a good description of Rome as well. And what I want to say is that there is nothing in the description, in my view, that would disqualify Rome. I'm not going to be dogmatic about it, but I do want to say that the description, as it's given in this text, there are a number of things in it which very much correlate with the city of Rome during this period of time in which the book was written. So let's note a couple of things. The first thing is that Rome sat upon seven hills. If you'll notice up on the TV screen, I put a map of the city of Rome. The city of Rome is outlined in red, and there are seven hills. Quirinal Hill, Viminal Hill, Capitoline Hill, Esquiline Hill, Palatine Hill, Salian or Caelian Hill, and Aventine Hill. Those are the hills. I don't know if I pronounced even a single one of those correctly. Plus, it's kind of a small writing on this little, so I may have not even seen the words clearly. So these are the hills upon, and you, if you talk about it, Rome is built upon seven hills. She is sitting on seven hills. Okay, does that mean that? Well, be honest, if I were to say that settles it, there'd be two problems with it. Number one, there are seven hills that Jerusalem sits upon as well. And you can go to that area, and in fact, Constantinople's the same, and there are others that say, okay, well, those would fit that description as well. Fair enough. That's one problem with saying this nails it down with regard to Rome. Second thing about that is, in order to be consistent with the way in which we've been interpreting the book, if we were to talk about this, hills, as meaning literal hills that the woman sat upon, then we, and be dogmatic about that, then we may be being a little bit inconsistent. We've talked about how the futurists will take some things as symbolic but other things as literal and be inconsistent with regard to that. The apocalyptic language is a language of symbols. And I want you to note, when we are told in verse 9, here is the mind which has wisdom, the seven hills are seven mountains on which the woman sits, and there are seven kings, that the hills here symbolize seven kings rather than a literal hills in this text. Now, could it be that the Holy Spirit and John is making a dual reference? Well, that happens a lot in prophecy, and it certainly could be the case here. So this may be an identifying factor. I would just say that it's not something that is a passage there that would exclude any other possibility. But it certainly does not disprove or disqualify Rome as the city that's under consideration. A second point to be made in this regard is we look at what the woman did. We are told that she is a seducer, that she seduces these kings that are mentioned here in the particular text of chapter 17. Notice the great harlot, verse 1 and verse 2, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So this is an indication of great influence. And if you look again at Rome, you will know that Rome and its influence was something that truly corrupted others. I'll just give you an example with regard to the Judean reign of kings. During the time of Jesus' life, up until the destruction of Jerusalem, there were a series of kings that reigned over Israel as vassals of Rome. They were the Herods, the family of the Herods, Herod the Great, as an example. The first one in the line that was granted the title of the King of Judea by the Roman Senate. So he was an Edomite, and he was told, man of influence, you can be the king over Judah. We'll put you as head over Judah. Now, what would the Senate, Roman Senate, want in return for his reigning on the throne? Well, it would be that he would accede to their wishes, that he would use his influence and his power to support the interests interests of his Roman patrons, of the Senate itself. And he certainly did that in his reign. We go all the way through to Herod Agrippa II, which was the final king, vassal king to Rome in the line of Herod's. He was reigning when the Judean revolt took place against Rome, which ended in the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. And Agrippa II, he wasn't on the side of the Jews who revolted against Rome. In fact, he contributed with his siding with the Romans to the fall of Jerusalem. So these individuals were corrupted by the influence that the harlot had upon them, or that Rome had upon them, using specifically the application that I would make. So that's another example to which we could refer. So the text describes, thirdly, a city that actively seduced kings through worldliness and idolatry. And I think that it is a significant thing to note with regard to harlotry, that harlotry is something that is used again and again. Okay, take Prophet Hosea as an example, but not only with regard to the unfaithfulness of Israel, but with regard to the practice of idolatry in the pagan nations as you look through the Old Covenant. So idolatry is often related to prostitution, of bringing in other gods, and it's used symbolically in that regard. So that would certainly describe Rome as well, a city that was active in promoting emperor worship, as we talk about here in the first century, in the latter part of the first century. And then finally, in verse 18, which I do think is a significant description given, indicating the greatness or the breadth of the influence that this great city had. The phrase great city indicates one that had power, and it reigns over the kings of the earth. That the perhaps best description, or the description given, best describes the city of Rome in the first century better than any of the other possibilities that might be given. At least the most direct description that is given. The woman whom you saw is that great city, a singular city, one above all other cities, one that everyone is familiar with, that reigns over the kings of the earth. And it seems to me that the more probable explanation of who the harlot is the city of Rome. All right, so I give my view. I do want to just make reference to some of the other views very quickly. But before I do, does anyone have anything they want to add to that, or any questions, any comments you want to share? All right, then the other possibilities. Papal Rome, which, of course, is a reference to their belief that it is referencing the Catholic Church, the papacy, that is because of the idea of the false religion that is involved in that. There are a group of individuals. There are some Christians who have taken this view. I may be wrong about this. I don't want to misconstrue, but I think Foy E. Wallace Jr. Took the position that much of what the book of Revelation is talking about is Catholicism. But I may be wrong about that, so I probably shouldn't have said it, since I may be wrong about it. But I do know that there are some who take that position. There is a little bit of a problem with that, is that the church apostasy which took place, which led to the establishment of a papacy, was something that was five and a half centuries following the writing of this particular book. And it strains credulity a bit to say that you could go that far into the future and reference an institution that didn't even exist yet as being what these people in the first century would be concerned about. In this description given, it has the same problem that you would have with regard to premillennial doctrine that we've talked about time and again in this. Yes, Ruel.
I'm probably wrong with this. You left me. I've heard quite a few discussions about papacy or the Roman Catholic Church, which you look at all that time. It talks about the bishops. They're called the Pope, all the bishops and other things. But it was. Did the Roman Catholic Church get its toehold right around
No, I really don't think you can say that. We'll say this, that the Emperor Constantine became a friend to Christianity. That's kind of, and again, use these terms accommodatively, but the Christian faith at a period of time, and this is toward the end of the empire, but was embraced by Constantine. And that was a bad thing because Constantine's influence basically turned Christianity into a state religion. And the structure of the Catholic Church very much approaches the structure of Rome at that time with an ecclesiastical hierarchy that existed. And that's why in AD 606, when we typically talk about the beginning of the papacy in the sense that the Bishop of Rome exalted himself to the position of basically the supreme leader of the Catholic Church. Pope Boniface, I believe, was his name. And that followed the Bishop of Constantinople seeking to do the same thing about a generation before or a few decades before. But anyway, with regard to that, it wasn't until 325 that the Nicene Creed was established, which was a creedal system, but the apostasy of the church began early, and we can see in the third century and even in the second century, even in the end of the first century, with regard to Gnosticism that seemed to be coming in, there were departures from the faith. If you talk about the Roman Catholic denomination, it'd be hard to pin down because it was an evolutionary process. I've always basically given the date as 606 AD because it was then when the power and authority of the papacy was given to one man as the Bishop of Rome. But that's kind of an arbitrary thing in that regard. So, but regardless, at the very least, when we talk about, and Dennis brought up something in his discussion a week or two ago with regard to the end of the empire, that it was a century or two before it comes to an end. But at least when you're talking about these kinds of events, you're talking about something that was in existence at the time of which the Apostle Paul or Apostle John was writing. In other words, it was something that was troubling them at that time. If you talk about papal Rome, about the Roman Catholic Church, that's something that wasn't in existence and not on the horizon and would have absolutely no significance, hold no significance for the suffering Christians here in the first century. So Jerusalem is the other choice, and the one thing about that is somewhat bothersome is verse 18. I do know that there are a number of explanations that are given with regard to the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. For example, a statement from Acts chapter 2 that there were Jews, devout men from every nation under heaven who were in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost. It is a little bit difficult to extrapolate from the existence of Jews throughout the nations to the fact that Jerusalem would reign, or Jerusalem as the woman would be reigning. But that's, again, just a view that I hold in that regard. And then the final one is literal Babylon, which, again, would have really no bearing upon the disciples at that time because the city didn't even exist anymore at the time of the writing. So it just doesn't seem right. I want to read you one statement concerning Rome during John's day from Brother Harkrider in his commentary that kind of sums up what I think is true as well. He said, "During John's day, Rome was the foremost city which debauched others in several ways, politically, socially, commercially, and even religiously. At specific times from the late first century and reaching into the second and third, Rome and its provincial officials enforced the imperial religion. This religious system that was put before the world is described in chapter 13 and verses 11 through 18, the false prophet, for example. And Rome indeed acted as a harlot. She caused the earthly inhabitants to commit spiritual fornication by worshiping the beast." And so that's something that I think serves as a pretty good description and conclusion with regard to my view of who the woman, the harlot, is. All right? So I've identified who I think she is. Any comments, questions that anybody wants to share with us? Yes, Josh?
Thinking about what you... I'm not saying her yet, But thinking about what you had to say about, well, why would first century Christians all be worried about a institution that didn't exist at the time? I don't know that that's really a good argument. Because just because the institution doesn't exist doesn't mean that it won't, or that God doesn't see it in the future. I mean, the whole of what we have and what we are today was known to God before the beginning of time.
Yep.
Biblical examples would be Abraham. The promises God made to him, he never saw it.
Yeah.
But it was quite relevant to him.
Yeah.
And then even looking at the imagery of empires, King Nebuchadnezzar had a dream of a great statue that we learn later on represented a ton of different empires that had many centuries to go before they even existed. So, but it was quite relevant to King Nebuchadnezzar.
Sure. So let me, I think I used a little bit of shorthand in describing that, so I want to refer back to the first chapter of Revelation, and what I intended by that was that the events which transpired were stated directly as being things that must shortly come to pass. And because of that, and the centering of the writing itself was to deal with issues that were troubling the brethren at that particular time. So in that, the idea that we're talking about Papal Rome or Babylon, for example, is two examples, that those would not contextually apply because those were not even in existence at the time that the things that must shortly come to pass took place. And basically, I was just using shorthand, but that was to what I referred. And I think that is a legitimate point. Yes, Justin.
Some people look at verse 10, and it's talking about the seven kings and five fell, and one is, and one has not yet come. They think that's a reference to the various kingdoms over time, like the Nebuchadnezzar statue. So starting with Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persian, Greek, Roman. As you go through that, that's the five, or the first five are five. Rome is what now is, and the one that's not yet to come is what comes after Rome. But he says that one's not going to last very long.
Right. Yep.
And so that's the timing they have there. And they're looking at two women, the harlot and then the woman that's in scarlet and purple. And it says that the beast that the woman in scarlet is on is going to attack the harlot, basically. Happening towards the end of 17. And God gave it into two parts to do with his mind and to act in one mind. And so then the harlot being the one who sits over the waters, it says that the waters are peoples and crowds and nations and languages.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea there is the harlot is almost just people in general. And people in general have rejected God. We see this over time. People in general reject God. And the Israelites are judged when they reject God. And Assyria is judged when it rejects God. And you see Jeremiah talking about the people of the waters, talking about Babylon, because of the Tigris and the Euphrates River. Of the water, and he says, hey, the Medes are about to come judge you because you gained ill favor with God. And so they view a harlot to be more metaphorical than a specific city, and more being a representation of just the general will or the general leadership. leadership or the general spiritual direction of the people. And kings being used to judge that, but that the kings are going to become irrelevant because the king, the seventh king is going to come and he's going to fade away. Seventh king gets a little fuzzy, we're trying to predict the future kind of thing. Some people think the seventh king is Germanic because the Germans are the ones who came in and desolated Rome. And then you're like, but Germany's still around. Well, yeah, Rome kind of is too. But the idea being there that Christianity spreads at that point to a point that the relevancy of Germany, or Rome for that matter, as compared to Christianity, is nothing. And Christianity at that point has become the mountain of cold water.
Okay. One thing that you mentioned in, as you began that, I appreciate, because we are, when we get into a discussion of the kings, the seven kings that are mentioned there, and we're kind of jumping back and forth because we're going through the identification of these things. But you mentioned two women, and that is a view that I am not as familiar with. The familiarity I have in my studies is the harlot and the woman are the same woman, but that at different stages, the reaction toward her is different. In other words, it is individuals who become disenchanted and turn on her that leads to the desolation. So I would like for you, if you've got some time this week, to kind of spend a few moments and present the arguments with regard to the two women in the interpretation. There are a lot of people that hold to the woman here, the harlot specifically, that it is that the woman that is identified in chapter 17 throughout from verse 1 through 18 is the same woman. And you may have seen that from my explanation that I was giving, that view as hell. But I'm interested in hearing more about what you have to say there in regard to it and why. Regardless, with regard to that, the view that I've taken is that being a reference to the city of Rome, which is upon the beast, and we'll talk a little bit more about it as we go through it. And see, it's one of the things that is a little bit problematic. It's difficult to be dogmatic. I've studied, I've got a number of commentators that I read, and I go through and I look at writings and different things, trying to get to an understanding of this and what seems best, what seems close to being right, and then someone comes up with a view that they've read somewhere or that they have come to themselves that I hadn't thought about. And it's very difficult for me to be dogmatic about any of these things in the text, and I'm interested in learning what you have to say about that. So we'll get into that a little bit more maybe next week. So let me see if I've... I lost my place in my notes now, but now I know where I am. Okay, so anybody else with regard to the great harlot before we go on to the next? All right, did the first bell ring? I think it didn't. Okay, so we'll look just very quickly at the kings of the earth stated in verse 2. And the point to be made here, the kings of the earth, that the harlot has an influence upon the world in general and those who are in the power, in a position of power. This would certainly include those vassal kings of which we referred earlier as they sought her favor, those who were influenced by her decadence. And I was just trying to, and we'll get into more of a discussion because it is interesting, the discussion of the seven kings and the ten kings in the next week. But if you want to think about the influence of Rome, the seductive influence on Rome, we may be nearing the end of it, but just think about the influence that the United States of America has had on the world, the cultural influence that we've had, religious influences that we've had, the influence of Hollywood, the influence of athletics, the influence of diplomacy, all of those kinds of things. It was not in any way an exaggeration to say that over the past, let's say since the 1940s at the very least, that the United States is the preeminent influencer of the world. And perhaps one of the problems with secularism and all the immorality and the ungodliness that exists is the United States has been in control of the influence for too long. So we can see kind of a parallel between that and the city of Rome and her influence upon the world outside and the kings of the earth. So keep that in mind. We'll pick up with an identification of the scarlet beast in our discussion next week. We didn't quite get down through all of that first column, but I think we'll finish that up, and we'll probably get through the second column fairly quickly, maybe even finish up our discussion of chapter 17 next week. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today. Thank you.